Good morning. It is good to see everybody once again. This is the last in the series of lessons we've had this month on apologetics. Answers in April is what they've titled it. And we've looked at some really interesting subjects and some really interesting questions and some really important questions. And I know that not everybody in here has questions about today's subject, which is evolution. Some of you have settled that in your mind long ago, and that's great. Some very well may have not settled that in their mind yet. And all of us will run into or have run into people who have not settled that question. And so having something in our arsenal to talk about is helpful. And I want to make this point at the beginning. Wednesday's lesson was fairly technical when we were talking about photosensitivity in one-celled organisms. Today's is not nearly so technical, fortunately. And the point I want to reinforce to that is that you don't need to know all those technicalities to understand the point. You don't need to be a biochemist to understand creation. And we don't need to speak Hebrew and Greek to have confidence in our scriptures. That's not what's necessary to have a strong faith. That's not how God designed it. We don't have to have a PhD in theology or biochemistry or anything else to be confident God exists and that we can know his will. But these can give us some tools and some insight to reinforce our faith. So let's start with a prayer together, and then we will get into this. Let's pray. Our Holy Father, you are good, and you are holy, and you are righteous, and we thank you for making us so through your power and your grace. And this morning, as we study about the world that you created, may we have insight into your nature and greater faith that you exist, and then a greater drive to get into your book, to know your mind, the mind that you've revealed to us, through which we can find the faith that makes us righteous. We pray that our hearts will be opened and that our hearts will be moldable and changed. That we will not take the path of easy thinking, but we'll do the hard work to understand your truth. We thank you for this church. We pray that through it, your name and the name of Jesus will shine in this community and beyond. In Jesus' name, amen. What we're doing this morning is what we've done the last couple of classes, which is taking a look not so much at this revelation of God, but his creation as revelation. And in Romans chapter 1 and Psalm 19 and others, passages of the Bible will tell us that you can know about God from his creation. That in itself is a revelation. You can't know his will through creation. You can't come to know who Jesus is. You certainly can't come to know what it means to be a Christian or how to be saved or what sin is by looking at creation. But you can come to know who God is as deity, that he is divine, that his attributes are evident in the world that he created. And so we're going to continue looking at that today. What I'd like to do is take a little look at evolution. And along the way, we're going to do a little bit of insight into what does Darwinism actually say? And then what are some of the evidences for it? I'd like to start with this question. Doesn't Darwin's tree prove evolution? If there's any image that is an icon for Darwinism, it's the tree of life. That all organisms share a common trunk. And that's the only image, in fact, that Darwin put in his book. It was this one. He wrote a very long book on the origin of species, where he articulated his ideas, published in 1859. One picture in that book. I want to tell you, science education has changed. You want to publish something in science now, you better have a lot of pictures. It's the way our culture has gone. They weren't picture heavy then. They were very word heavy. If you ever have trouble sleeping, pick up a copy of Darwin's On the Origin of Species and start reading it. It'll doze you pretty quickly. But there is a picture in it. I think in chapter 4. And it's his version of a tree. And so what you have down here is letters A through L, which all represent, in his case, variations of a species. A is not exactly like B or exactly, but they're all variations. And time passes as you move from the bottom to the top. And so you see some, over time, change very little, if at all. Like look at variation G. There's no change, there's no branches on that tree, just a trunk, and the trunk ends. That means it goes extinct after a period of time. And the same thing with some of these others. D and E go a little longer, but they go extinct and all. But some of these have a lot of branches in them, like A. So over time, A branches into this crit. You can see that word or that letter at all. That's A1 and M1. So after a little bit of time, species A has branched into two distinct varieties. You might just call one A1 and the other M1. And over a little more time, A1 stays the same until about up here. M1 changes pretty quickly into M2 and S something. And so by the time you're done, enough time has passed. And here at the top of the tree, you have a variety of organisms that then exist. And they're different than what they started with. His tree of life. And so he said, look, if you can imagine that, and you don't have to imagine that, we can see that. That happens all the time. I'm going to show you some illustrations of that in a second. We don't have to imagine that. We can see it. That you start with one organism, and over time, you get varieties that are different from each other. So if we can take what we can see, and then just expand that in our mind, then all organisms share one common origin, one trunk. And so all the millions of species that we see today on the planet have a common origin. That was Darwinism. And if there's any image that illustrates Darwinism, it's the tree. Doesn't that prove evolution? The tree. You go to any natural history museum and you're going to see it. You open any textbook and you're going to see multiple versions of the tree as it goes through the book. The big massive tree that shows everything, and then little trees, just mammals. What's the mammal tree? And what's the flowering plant tree? And whatever kind of other organisms you want to get into. And so what Darwin suggests in his book, two fundamental ideas. The first, that populations change over time. An argument nobody disagrees with or ever has. At least not in any kind of recent history. Everybody can see it. Second key argument he made is that those changes are due to natural selection. Nature puts stress on organisms. Nature's a pretty brutal place. Blind squirrels don't get to breed. Weak deer don't get to breed. Slow rabbits don't get to breed because nature will kill them. They'll eliminate them. And that's just the way it works. And so nature's going to select out traits that don't survive, and it will select four traits that are an advantage, and those traits tend to accumulate. Cheetahs get faster. Rabbits get sensitive ears. Hawks get really good eyes. And ones that are born or hatched with deficiencies in those traits tend not to breed because they get eliminated by nature. And that's, again, not too many people really are going to argue that because we see that happen all the time in nature. What I'd like to suggest this morning that instead of a tree, we really ought to consider a forest for several reasons. At the end, I think this is very much the picture you get in Genesis. And we're going to talk about that. Instead of a tree of life, let's consider a forest instead. Why should we consider a forest? Just looking around us. Well, one is an event called the Cambrian Explosion. The Cambrian Explosion. I'm going to explain what the Cambrian Explosion refers to. When scientists were first naming things, all they had to look at was physical traits. And that's how they named stuff. And a guy named Carl Linnaeus started what we know of as our naming system. And he just wanted to organize living things. Because how do you talk about it? You got to talk about things. And so to talk, you have to organize it. So he said, well, let's just start putting things into groups. And he started with a really big group, so he called those groups kingdoms. And so there's an animal kingdom. And everything that's called an animal fits in that group. And there's a plant kingdom. And anything that can be called a plant is dumped in the plant kingdom. And then there's other kingdoms. That's how he started it. And his basic structure of naming is still what we use today. And we still have those kingdoms. There's an animal kingdom and a plant kingdom. There's a fungus kingdom and there's a couple others. And that's been changed over the years. But that's the idea. You can organize stuff. And you keep going down the list. There's a kingdom. Does anybody happen to know what comes underneath the kingdom? Every kingdom can then be subdivided, right, into smaller groups. Anybody know what we call those groups? Phylum. Oh, very good. Oh, yeah, of course, Allison would know. Phylum. After a phylum, you have a class, and then order. Then families, and then genus, and the last one, species. Right, species. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. You want to remember that? Dumb King Philip came over from Germany swimming. There you go. That finishes it all. King Philip came over from Germany swimming. That's your acronym for it. And we now have broader categories called domains. So we call them Dumb King Philip, which is fine. But so specifically at the bottom, everything has a genus and species name. Anybody know the human genus and species name? Homo sapien, right? We are Homo sapien. And so every organism gets a specific genus and species name that makes it unique. All right, that's how we name things. Well, the Cambrian explosion refers to rock strata. More on this kingdom, phylum, class, order stuff in just a second. And this is what it means. Geologists, and I'm not a geologist. Let's be very transparent up front about that. I am not a geologist. I took one geology course. It ended up pretty much being rocks for jocks kind of class at the University of Florida. Not the most educationally advantageous course I ever took. But I think half the athletic department was in there. But the Cambrian explosion refers to a layer of the strata. Now, this is well beyond what we're going to talk about. The whole idea of a geologic strata is its own discussion. There is no geologic column where you go and you see every layer that we say exists. That doesn't exist on the planet. So they've built a geologic column based on different places in the world where different layers are found. And we all know what, if you've ever driven out, if you've lived in Florida your whole life and never gotten out of it, you have no idea what a strata is. But if you've ever gotten out of Florida and you drive through the mountains, you see strata. Where you've blown the mountains apart, you can see different layers of rock, very distinct from each other. And each layer is called a strata. One of those is called the Cambrian. And what happens when you get to the Cambrian, well, let's start before the Cambrian. You get to layers below the Cambrian, and you know what kind of fossils they find there? Almost nothing. Almost nothing is there. But once you hit the Cambrian, there's an explosion of varieties. Almost every animal phyla is represented in the Cambrian, has been found as a fossil in the Cambrian. So it's like you have an explosion of diversity once you hit Cambrian rock. And all these phyla are there. Phyla is the second major group, right? The first is kingdom, animals. Then below that you have phyla. And below that you get a bunch of other subgroups. So phyla are really broad categories. And almost everyone is there when you hit the Cambrian level. And so you have, worms and mollusks and chordates. That's the phyla you and I belong to. Sponges are there, one of the simplest phyla of animals. And everything's there. Why? That doesn't fit a tree. It doesn't fit the Darwin's tree, which is that you start slow and over long periods of time, you have very slow, gradual change. That's not what the Cambrian explosion shows. What it shows is all at once, huge diversity of animal life. And that's a real struggle for Darwinists to suggest. What you see is more of a forest than a tree. And it's not just that you have an abundance of fossils, you got lots of them. And it's not just that you have a diversity, lots of different types. But you have a diverse abundance all at once. That doesn't fit a tree model. It fits very well into a forest model, but it doesn't fit the tree model. Some even will say, in fact, that the Cambrian explosion turns the tree upside down. That instead of a tree with a trunk that branches and gets broader as it goes up, the Cambrian explosion starts broad. What you see is almost every phyla there, and then several start going extinct. Branches are missing the farther you go. So it's like you're pruning the tree as time progresses, which is exactly the opposite of what we would expect to happen. The Cambrian explosion significantly challenges the idea of a tree. Another evidence of a forest is biochemical comparisons. And this has happened much more in recent years. This is the idea. As I mentioned, when they were first trying to figure out how are living things related to each other, all we could do is look at living things and look what looks more similar to each other. And we put those in a group and assume those are more closely related. But that's a fairly raw, gross kind of comparison. What really matters is the molecular evidence. Can you get into genes? Because that's what builds organisms in the first place, the gene of an organism. And can we compare genes with each other? Very simply, this is what genes are. genes are DNA. And DNA is just a code with letters in it. And in fact, there's only four letters in DNA. A, C, G, and T. And that code is just a string of these letters. Your DNA is about 3.5 billion letters long. That's what it takes to build your tent. That's what I tell my students. It doesn't build you. You're made of much bigger stuff than DNA. But it builds the tent in which you exist. That's how Paul put it, right? DNA builds your tent. It takes about 3.5 billion letters in every cell of your body, almost, to build that. Well, what you can do then is take a couple of living things and compare. If you have letters, what do you do with letters? What do you build out of letters? Build words out of them. And DNA has words in it. And I'm not going to go into this. This is another lecture. What do you build out of words? Sentences. And DNA has sentences in it. Complete with punctuation. Capital letters to start with. Pauses in the middle. Where you know how to end. How you know how to... Is this a sentence or is this a woo sentence? All that's in DNA. But that's a whole other lesson. But the point is, if every living thing has this code in it, then you can compare two living things. That's the theory anyway. It goes like this. Organism 1 has this simple little word, or series of words. C-G-G-T-A-A-T-C. Well, let's say organism number 2 has this sequence in it. And it differs in only one letter. Where organism 1 has an A, organism 2 has a G. Get that? Organism number 3 now differs in a second letter. That third letter N, instead of being a G, we change it to a T. And this happens over time because your letters aren't exactly the same as the letters of your ancestors. Genes tweak a little bit. They change. And we'll just throw one more up there. Organism number 4. So if we have four organisms, we can line them up. And we can compare the letters in their DNA. And it goes like this. You all can figure out this. Which is most closely related to organism number 1? I kind of lined them up for you. So this is a Sunday morning Christian group. Don't want to push them too hard. Yeah, pretty obviously, organism number 2 is the most similar to number 1. So to an evolutionist, that's the most closely related. See how that works? It's not complex. I mean, the idea isn't complex. If they're more similar, they're more closely related. Which are assumed to be more closely related to an alleged evolutionary ancestor. Number 1 and number 2, or number 1 and number 3? It's the same question. Which ones are assumed to be most closely related? Number 1 and number 2. All right, this is how they do that, and they line them up. And you can do that with much more letters than this illustration shows. Well, that's fine. And they started doing those comparisons, and now this is largely how we compare things, is molecular evidence. DNA and another molecule very similar to it called RNA. In fact, that's maybe the most commonly used. RNA is. But a couple of things to think about with this comparison thing. First, you have to know where to start lining things up. How do you know which letter ought to be right here is number 1, and then we go? Because you can imagine, if you shift this top organism one letter off, then those comparisons are completely different. Just shift organism number 1, the one letter over, and you're going to get completely different results. And figuring out exactly where to start is a bit of a question. And there's assumptions you have to make in deciding what your starting point is. And that will drastically change your results. So it's not clean and simple, even from the very beginning. Second, the more they've done this, the more they've realized the results are not clean and simple like a tree ought to show. Results are different. No consistent, this is a quote, from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, from a, can I black out this screen? No. All right. I'll do that. I don't want you reading while I'm talking. This is a quote from a professor at the University of Illinois, sort of the father of a lot of this genetic comparison. Carl Weiss is his name. I'm not sure. It's W-O-E-S-E. How do you pronounce that? Very big name in microbiology especially. And this is what he had to say in a journal article of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. No consistent organismal phylogeny, that means evolution history. Your ancestry is your phylogeny. No consistent organismal phylogeny has emerged from the many individual protein phylogenies so far produced. Phylogenetic incongruities can be seen everywhere in the universal tree, from its root. He's talking about the evolutionary tree. There's inconsistencies all over the place, from the very roots of the tree to the major branchings within and among the various taxa to the makeup of the primary groupings themselves. What he's saying is what they had hoped for, which is a nice, very clean lines of evolutionary descent when they compared the genetics and proteins of one organism to another, has not happened. In fact, there's incongruities all over the place. It hasn't cleaned up the tree. It's just muddied it even more. You know why? I think it's because the tree doesn't fit. A tree's a bad model. A forest is a much better model. And you try to force data into a tree, it just doesn't fit well. And that's still where we are in a lot of those comparisons. A third evidence, this is the last, an evidence for a tree. This is the last core evidence, and we're going to look at some other questions. Is all the genetic changes we have done and the limits that we run into. When you look at changes in organisms, nobody argues that you can change a lot. There's all kinds of corn. And corn 200 years ago is not at all the corn you and I eat today, not even close. It's corn, but it's very different. If you look at it, even pictures and sketches of corn, you can see it's changed. It's much bigger, the kernels are much fatter, and there's a lot more oil in them. That's because we've made it that way. We've bred corn to be that way. And now we genetically modify it to be that way. Because we want as much corn oil out of an acre as we can get. Right? That's what businesses want. So you want as much oil out of an ear of corn as you can get. And so we've bred them that way. We breed dogs that way. We breed horses that way. We breed tomatoes. You breed mushrooms. You can breed anything to go in a specific direction. But at the end of the day, you can't breed it into anything. You can breed corn. At the end of the day, what do we have? Corn. And you can breed tomatoes. At the end of the day, what are you going to have? Tomatoes. They're going to be different colors. They're going to be different sizes. They grow in different kind of clumps. But at the end of the day, it's a tomato. We have done everything imaginable to bacteria because they grow very, very fast. And nobody cares what you do to bacteria. There's no ethical concerns to bacteria. You can do anything and nobody cares. And they're only one cell big. We have taken E. coli, and we know every letter in the genome of that E. coli, because it's not that big. And we can cut and splice and mix and match, puzzle piece, whatever we want, to every letter of E. coli. And we've been playing around with bacteria for, I don't know how, for a long, long time. A long, long time. At the end of the, there's a pretty famous study that's been running since 1988. It's still running. And they started with a broth of E. coli, a single uniform broth of E. coli. And they've exposed succeeding generations of that, successive generations of that, to different environments. Temperature, salt content, a lot of variety of nutrition, what's available to those E. coli and what aren't. Some of those lines die out. And some of those lines evolve. And they're now able to metabolize something that the original culture was not able to metabolize. They can metabolize nutrients the original culture could not. And we have forced, very strongly forced changes on those cultures of E. coli. At the end of the day, you know what those things are? They're E. coli. They're not even a different type of bacteria. We haven't turned E. coli into a staph type of bacteria. It's still an E. coli. And everywhere you look, when we try to force evolutionary change on something, we can force change, we can force a lot of change, and at the end of the day, you run up to a wall where change is limited. That's the data. That's what you can see. What a Darwinist do is take that observation and say, look, this E. coli can now metabolize a sugar that it couldn't 6 months ago. And they'll say, that proves practically, that strongly suggests that E. coli led to human beings. It is an incredible jump of faith. Incredible leap of faith. They're taking this observation that E. coli can become a different strain of E. coli and saying bacteria can become something entirely different. And you need to understand the significance of that jump. It's not a step. You are jumping the Grand Canyon, making that step. And we need to appreciate that. So those three things are evidence for a forest, in my view. Here's another example. I don't want to get to that picture yet. There you go. Those three. We may get back to that picture in a minute. I may have to back up. The Cambrian explosion, biochemical comparisons, and limited changes that what we can observe all suggest strongly that maybe a tree isn't the best idea. Maybe a forest is a much better idea. The challenge with a tree, focusing on the evolutionary tree, is that it leads to unnecessary errors in biology. And it's led to them in the past. Even in my limited experience, it has led to very obvious errors. And this happens to anybody, any of us, when we get focused on one answer, and that has to be the answer, we just mess up all kinds of things, don't we? Because we close our mind to other options. We do this biblically. You see this in the book of John. I won't take a lot of time to read through this, but you see it. John wrote his epistle. Why did he write his gospel? He wrote it so that you might believe. And what you see in that gospel is how different people react to the very same evidence. One example is Nicodemus in John 3. And he comes to Jesus by night, and he comes with questions, and Jesus gives him this answer that he really has a hard time understanding about being born again. And he leaves that exposure with Jesus still, I think, clearly confused. He's having a very difficult time wrapping around his head, who is Jesus? Now, at the end of the book, he's still there, isn't he? He pops up again at the end of John with Joseph of Arimathea there at the cross. So Nicodemus was one who was wrestling with trying to figure out the evidence, but he stays with it. Then there's those in the book of John who, the blind man of John 9, for example. Well, whether this guy's a sinner or not, I don't know, but I tell you what I know. I know I was blind and now I see, and that tells me something. I know what I can observe. You say whatever you want about him, but I know what I've seen. I know what I literally have seen. And you had that group who, when they saw Jesus, and they had to grow too, but they fairly quickly latched on to who he was. And then you have those at the very end who are shouting, crucify, crucify him, the Jewish leaders who had the same evidence as everyone else, crucify him, crucify him. What was the trouble? One reason they had such trouble believing, and one reason Nicodemus struggled to believe, is because what everybody had as the cultural norm for Messiah didn't fit. And the evidence didn't fit what they expected the evidence to fit. And it led them all kinds of terrible ideas and mistaken ideas. The tree of life does the same thing. I want to illustrate that. Let's say there's no tree. Well, in many ways, then it makes things make a lot more sense. But if you insist there's a tree, then you very likely bought into the idea of junk DNA. I was sitting in my class at the University of Florida at the feet of Dr. Lincoln Brower. Lincoln Brower was a pretty well world-renowned evolutionary biologist. He was a member of the Linnaean Society, which is an international honor society for scientists. It's full of hip, cool people, the Linnaean Society. What made him really big is that Dr. Brower had been on Reading Rainbow. Woo! Reading Rainbow. And you know you're big if you make it on Reading Rainbow. He was an evolutionary biologist. He studied butterflies. You all know what a monarch butterfly looks like? Bright orange and black butterfly. Really pretty butterfly. If a bird eats a monarch butterfly, you know what happens to that bird? They get violently sick and they puke their guts out is what happens. Violently sick. There's a toxin in those things. Well, there's another butterfly. It looks very similar to a monarch called a viceroy butterfly. Birds can eat those things all day long and just get fat. But they tend not to, they think, because they look so much like a monarch. And they sort of learn their lesson on a monarch. Right? You get food poisoning eating some food, there's a good chance you're not going to eat that food for a while, right? Well, that was Dr. Lincoln Brower's research. He did all that research and made that really popular. He told us this about DNA in my evolutionary biology class. And I was in there as a slightly under-ready student because one of the prereqs of that class I hadn't been able to take. It was full. And my advisor said, don't worry about it. You'll be fine. I'll put you in there. I hadn't had genetics yet. I hadn't taken genetics. And to not take genetics and then take evolution is kind of a bad idea. But I said, okay, so I took it. This is what DNA does. DNA is a code that's copied into another version of that code called RNA. And then your cells use RNA to make proteins. DNA is used to make proteins. That's his job. Only 5% or less of human DNA actually does that. 5% of human DNA codes for proteins. What's the other 95% doing? Well, Dr. Lincoln Brower and my textbook and everyone in biology said this. And this wasn't that long ago. I know you think it is, students, but it wasn't that long ago. This is mid-90s. They said, look, it's obviously leftover evolutionary junk. It's evolutionary detritus. That's what they would call it. It's just detritus. It's the leftover waste of our evolutionary past. In fact, it's a strong evidence of our evolutionary past. What kind of creator would make DNA to make protein and fill it with 95% DNA that doesn't do that? No creator would do that. It's garbage. Well, I didn't know what to say to that. I had a strong hint that was wrong, but I didn't know exactly what to say to that. Well, that was right at the edge of the molecular revolution. We were really getting able to study DNA efficiently and quickly. What, just your gut instinct, you are critical-minded people. What would you think if someone said this? 5% of human DNA codes for proteins, which is true. The 95% that doesn't is leftover junk. As a critical thinker, what would you say to that? Maybe we just don't know what 95% of it does. Maybe we're just 95% ignorant. Is that possible? Anything in human history to suggest that might be a really reasonable position to take? Of course that's the reasonable position to take. And it's proven to be true. And what we absolutely know now is it takes the other 95% to make that 5% work right. Without question. You have a gene. You have every gene in every cell of your body. You could grow liver tissue in your heart if you wanted to. The genes for it are there. You could grow bone in your liver. If you wanted to do that, the genes are there. I didn't get a picture of this because it's kind of gross, but it's really biologically cool. There's this type of tumor called a teratoma. Oma means tumor. Terat means monster. It's a tumor that grows. All a tumor is uncontrolled cell growth. That's the other part of this 95%, by the way. You got to control how fast all this is growing, and you better have your brake and gas pedal regulated. And that's critical. That gets out of regulation, you get cancer. And there's a type of tumor called a teratoma. And a teratoma is a monstrous tumor because all kinds of genes get turned on that aren't supposed to be on in that tissue. And you get a tumor that's full of weird kind of tissues. It'll have teeth growing in it. You'll see molars and incisors and canines. And in there, it'll grow all kinds of blood vessels. It'll grow hair. You'll see fingernails and toenails growing in it. It's a really weird looking tumor. And I know some of you have experienced that, probably, because they're not all that uncommon. Called a teratoma. That's what happens when 95% doesn't work right. Is the other 5% doesn't work right at all. Why would they conclude 95% doesn't do anything? It's just leftover. I tell you why. I think because they're so focused on the evolutionary tree that it blinds us to our own ignorance. And if we see something that we think fits our model, that's the answer. That's dangerous. It's dangerous in Bible study, too. Junk DNA. Another issue is the whole idea of vestigial organs, which is far less popular an idea than it used to be. And that's the idea that organs exist now that have no function because they used to have a function. Your appendix, for example. No function. They used to say. We now know it does have a function, in fact. And you can live without it. But you can live without your right arm, too. Right? Doesn't mean you don't need it. You can live without your tonsils. I ask this question in class almost every semester. Also, how many of you have had your tonsils taken out? And in a class of 40 or 50, you know how many students today have had their tonsils taken out? Maybe two or three, typically. 20 years ago, how many would have had their tonsils taken out? The majority. Over half, probably. We've learned you kind of need those things. I mean, you can live without them, but it's helpful to have them. So, rather than just cut them out, if we can cure the infection in other ways, we try to do that. So the vestigial organ thing has really, again, it's more of an argument of ignorance. We don't know what an organ does, therefore it doesn't do anything. That kind of an argument. It's a pretty weak argument. And then I want to talk about micro versus macro evolution and mistakes that are made if I focus on the tree, particularly in this concept. You all know. All right, this row right here. I told them that they were going to have to be paying attention. What does micro mean? Micro, yes, ma'am. Tiny, good. Micro means tiny. Macro then means? Big, good. What kind of evolution are we talking about? Micro versus macro. What Darwin saw and what we see all the time is microevolution. Dogs change, corn changes, that kind of stuff. And that led to the conclusion of macroevolution. Huge changes over very long periods of time. And that's what Darwin witnessed. There was a very famous study by a couple, the Grants, Rosemary and Mr. Grant. I don't remember his name. They went to the Galapagos Islands that were very famous because Darwin had stopped there. And they did a study of finches for 20 years. They measured beaks. They picked one island, a small island, and they banded every single bird on the islands. They could track every single individual. And they banded every single hatchling. So they could track over 20 years every single individual finch on that island. And they measured beak sizes. Fascinating way to spend 20 years of your life, isn't it? Catching birds and measuring beaks. And this is what they noticed. That over time, beaks changed in response to the weather. This blue line shows, here's the vertical axis is how many finches there are, the number of birds. The horizontal axis is the size, beak size. So the blue represents rainy seasons. The brownish color represents areas of drought. And so what you notice is during a rainy season, the average beak size, sort of the peak of the hill, is smaller than in a drought. That when droughts came, average beak sizes increased. And you could quantify that. You can measure that numerically. And that makes sense. Because in drought, the smallest seeds dry out and go away faster. Because it's just too dry. And the plants that make them tend to die out. And you get more plants with hardier seeds, more robust seeds. And so birds with small beaks like this can't open seeds like that, and they starve and they die. So the average size of the population gets bigger when you have a drought. And nobody questions that. That's obvious. We can see that happen. That's microevolution, right? Beak size changes over time. And if the season was rainy, then the average size got smaller because there's more of those seeds. Those can survive. There's fewer of these seeds, so the big beaked finches starve. Some of them do. Well, let me look at another piece of data. And this isn't the best image, but it's the best one I could find. And it's telling. Here's the beak size on the left. Starts, whatever this is, about 9.5, so it looks like, millimeters, between 9 and 10. And this is time. There's the year. Starts in, I guess, 76, 77, 78, yeah, I guess that's right. And you just move along the line. For 20 years, they did this. And this illustrates actually the whole thing. The beak size goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. And I want to make the statement that this has, by more than one evolutionary biologist, been said to be one of the clearest, most powerful examples of Darwinism ever studied. You need to know that before I tell you the next obvious thing that this chart illustrates. One of the most powerful evidence of Darwinism ever. This was chronicled in a Pulitzer, I think they won the Pulitzer Prize winning book called The Beak of the Finch. They chronicled this whole story. You notice something on this chart? Look at the point in the first year they started and the average beak size. You see it? Look at the average beak size at the last year on this chart. What is it? It's the same! After 20 years, you know what happened? Zero net change in beak size on the island. Zero. It went up, it went down, and at the end of the day, the beak was exactly where it started. Does that get to you a little bit that scientists use that kind of evidence and say that's the best example of Darwinism and the tree of life that we can show you. And you're a fool if you don't believe the tree of life. That makes me angry. Because it's intellectually dishonest. It's a great study. It's good biology. The conclusions are terrible. However, micro versus macro evolution. It's important that we understand that difference, that we understand what it really says. I'm going to go back to my wolf picture quickly, as we're running out of time here. Does the bell ring a quarter till 45? Okay. Good. Okay, 45 and 50. I want to show you this picture and talk about micro versus macro evolution. Somehow I plugged this way up too high in the PowerPoint show. We think, based on biochemical comparisons, DNA comparisons, that modern domestic dogs have all descended from the gray wolf. That human civilizations in different continents have taken wolves and bred them to become docile and now domesticated. And that's what seems to be true. Well, how do you go from White Fang to that? In Eden, were there poodles? No. Wild poodles have never roamed the earth. And they never will. They will be eliminated very quickly. We can force all kinds of change. At the end of the day, what do you have? You have a dog. Now, I don't know what was in Eden, but there was a dog there. Every niche in our world has a dog-like animal in it, doesn't it? Here in Florida, what's our dog-like animal? What do we have? We have coyotes. We have coyotes here. What else do we have? We have foxes. We have coyotes and foxes here. You go far north, you still have wolves running around, right? Jump the pond, go to Africa. What do they have over there? They have hyenas, wild dogs, I think jackals are over there. And you go around the world, and there's a dog everywhere. Well, did God create hyenas and wild dogs and jackals and a desert fox and an Arctic fox and a Florida fox and a coyote and a... I don't think so. Dingoes are sort of their own thing. Yeah, that's true. They're marsupials, which is interesting. No, I don't think he did. I don't have any reason to think he did. I have reason to think he created something like a dog. And what we have today is what we have today. And some have longer legs, some have thicker fur, some have a longer snout, a stubbier snout, different shaped ears. But they're all a dog. You can tell, you can look at it and say, yeah, that's a dog. It's little, it's a fox. That's big, that's a wolf. That's a dog, though. Microevolution. And I want to make this point in relation to microevolution. Because Christians, I think, particularly in this subject, can box ourselves in a place we don't need to be. And make ourselves sound awfully, awfully wrong. Doesn't this sound, though, an awful lot like Genesis chapter 1? Each reproduces after its kind. What's a kind? Don't say species. Don't say species. The Bible does not have the word species in it. We make up that word. We have made that up. Carl Linnaeus made up the word species. That's not a biblical word. I don't know what kind is. And neither do you. Neither does anybody. What we know is there's limits. That's surely what the data suggests. There's limits. But don't say species. And this is why you should not say species. A species, I'll give you a couple of different definitions here, is often defined as a group of individuals that actually or potentially interbreed in nature. And that came from some official source, right? I think that came off a Berkeley website. Oh, no, it's the National Science Teachers Association. No, it's not. That's Berkeley. Okay, that was Berkeley. Pretty well-respected institution. Certainly not a creationist institution. The classic definition of species is this. A species is an organism that can interbreed and have fertile offspring. So, you get a horse and a donkey, and you breed them and you get a mule. A mule can't breed. Mules are sterile. Therefore, are horses and donkeys the same species? No. They can breed, but their offspring can't breed, so they're not the same species. A lion and a tiger can breed, and you get a liger. Ligers, and they're real. Ligers are real. But they can't, they're sterile. They can't breed. Therefore, are lions and tigers the same species? No, they're not. But the species definition is very hazy. It's not a hardcore, clear-cut definition. Be very careful taking words that we make up and we define and forcing them into Scripture, because God did never said each species will replicate after its species. Is it true that we have never seen a new species made? That depends on how you define a species. Let me give you an example. Plants, some plants have the ability to do something pretty weird. Animals can't. Only one mammal has ever done this that we can tell. And that is, you can take the number of chromosomes. A chromosome is just a string of DNA. And every organism has a certain number of chromosomes in it, pieces of DNA. And you have to have the right matchup in order to reproduce. So some plants in one generation can double the number of chromosomes in them. Ferns can do this. So take a fern that has 12 chromosomes. And for millennia, it's had 12 chromosomes, 12 chromosomes, 12 chromosomes. And in one generation, it'll double and have 24. Well, you take a fern with 24 chromosomes and a fern with 12 chromosomes, can those two things breed together? No, they can't. You just have a new species of fern. It looks the same. It's still a fern, but it's a new species. Because those two ferns can't interbreed with each other anymore. And so now you have the 12-chromosome fern and the 20-chromosome fern, and now those are going to continue producing. Do not say speciation never happens. That all depends on how you define species, and God hasn't defined it. We have. Don't box ourselves into that. It's a dangerous place to be, biologically, and as evidence goes. And don't let that throw you. Don't let that mess with your faith, that maybe species can form. Well, we make up that word, so don't let that bother to you. We've completely made up that construct. What is the limit of kind? I don't know. What I know is we have never seen an E. coli even become another type of bacteria. We've done everything to a fruit fly you can do it. We've nuked it, we've chopped it, we've diced it, we've spliced it, we've microwaved it, we've done everything to a fruit fly you can do to a fruit fly. And it's still a fly, just one that can't fly. The evidence that there's limits to change is extremely strong. Extremely strong. And that's why, in my judgment, is it a tree that is the best fit for evolution? Or is it something different than that? This quote, this comes from the National Science Teachers Association and their position on evolution. Biological evolution refers to the scientific theory that living things share ancestors from which they have diverged. It is sometimes called descent with modification. Nobody argues that definition. Everybody knows living things change from their ancestors. The question is, what extent? To what extent does that change go? Is the best model a tree, where all living things, and by the way, the only data on any tree is the very tip, the little dots at the top of that tree, that's the only data on any tree in any textbook or any natural history museum. Everything else on this picture is inference. It's things we think. Is it a tree? Or is it a forest? That's the best model. Biblically, you see a forest. And there's a lot of good reasons to think the evidence of nature is a forest. What we need to be careful doing, not to do, is to miss the forest for the tree. Because we're so focused on that's the way it must be. And we miss the forest. Because we're staring at one tree. And that's not the real data around us. I appreciate so much your attention. Yeah, Benji? You may. You have a minute. Yeah. Yeah, epigenetics is the understanding that there's a lot more influence on your genes than just your genes changing letters. There's all kinds of influences on there. Oh, the broad picture of that is, yeah, that's just another way to change the genetics of things. So the question is, how far can that change take an organism? And we still run into, the evidence is, you still run into the same kinds of wall, same kind of boundary.
Those dogs have different genes, right?
Right. Yeah, some. Stop. animating. Yeah, some like this dot versus that dot versus that dot. Yeah, some of the genes are very different. Some of them are identical. There are some genes that are in every living thing ever seen. Some proteins are in everything ever seen. Which makes a whole interesting study I didn't get to talk about. Because I wasn't confident. I'm not confident. I don't want to step out and make this argument until I'm really confident this is a good argument to make. And I don't know that it is yet. There's a whole argument about comparing those the sequences of those proteins and the way the sequences fall out. I mean, it's a forest. It's an obvious forest. But I got to work on that some more before I share it. Great question. Thank you.